explore the little things that can inspire us all. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib. Listen to Small Joys, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. Delighted to have your company. Welcome to All Sides Weekend Books. This is our monthly book show, and we have a wonderful panel assembled. They have all brought stacks of books with them to recommend to you, to us. And let me introduce Chris Hickey, who is the Youth Services Manager at the Whetstone Branch of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Chris Hickey comes each month to give us the latest in the quick picks of the library. She will explain that concept and then recommend some titles. Just back from vacation. So welcome back and thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cassie Rose is here. Cassie is WOSU's book critic. She is the book critic of the world. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com, which is indispensable for anyone who loves to read. That's thelongestchapter.com. Cassie also speaks at panels and in book discussions throughout our community. Welcome, Cassie Rose.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
And as I've said before, there ain't no show without you. We are delighted to welcome a new member of the family. Mark Sebastian Jordan is an author, a raconteur, a storyteller, a historian, a program note annotator. He is based in the Mansfield area, and he has just written a book called The Seely Rose Murders at Malabar Farm. Welcome, Mark Sebastian Jordan.
Thank you.
Delighted to have you all here. And I want to start with Chris Hickey because you're rested, because you've had vacation.
I'm rested.
You've rested. And first of all, if you don't know this yet, at least at Whetstone, the Columbus Library System is completely back up and running.
Yes, we are definitely, we are very close to being completely 100% open. Meeting rooms are available. We're talking about opening our school help center in the fall. And something exciting that's coming up is we have an open house system-wide on August 21st. So every location is going to have a menu of events happening throughout the day. There'll be live music some places. There'll be story times. We'll have paid performers. There will be, you know, some book discussions. So lots of really fun things happening that day.
Will there be cake?
There will be snacks. Okay. I don't know if it's cake.
Well,
but there will be snacks.
Okay, good to know. But there will be books. There will be all
lots
the library materials and the wonderful people who work for the library system, and that's why people are going in there. Explain quickly again the concept of what a quick pick is, and then give me one.
Okay, so quick picks. So the idea is that these are the really popular books, very long hold lists. So the idea is you may have this book on reserve. You might be number 665, but you walk into one of our locations and it's right there on the quick pick display. You can check it out, jump the line, and then it will take it off of your reserve and you can read it immediately. So that is the idea.
There is one day where you're supposed to get there like at 5 in the morning and stand and wait for the doors to unlock, because that's the day you sort of replenish. What's
Tuesday.
Tuesday.
It's on Tuesdays. That's usually
Tuesday's
a release
the
day
when they're all new. Okay. All Sides Weekend Books is the discussion right now. Chris Hickey is the Youth Services Manager of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. What do you have for us as a quick pick?
Okay, so Grady Hendrix has a new novel, and of course he's the great horror writer. He wrote Horror Store, which is the book about the haunted IKEA-like store. He wrote Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires, and his new one is called The Final Girl Support Group. So Final Girl is a concept that, it, you know, was made popular in the 80s and 90s movies. It's the girl at the end of the movie who has survived this horrific traumatic event and has vanquished the monster. So in this story, these are
usually Jennifer
real
Lawrence.
Final.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Okay.
These are in this novel, they are real final girls. So these are six women who have had some horrific traumatic event. Movies have been made about them, and they've all been treated by this same psychiatrist. So the psychiatrist has become famous for treating these women. And so the public is fascinated with them in a very macabre, disturbing way. They have stalkers. It's kind of gross. But what people don't know is that they have a monthly support group with this doctor in the basement of some, you know, random place. So the six women have been meeting monthly for years until one of them dies. And so it appears that someone is starting to pick them off. So who is going to be the final girl of the final girls? So the main character is a woman named Lynette. And we really get into her psyche. She's a woman who, for good reason, is extremely paranoid. When she leaves her home, which is rare, she's armed to the teeth. So she'll have a razor blade taped to her leg. She has guns. She has knives. And her apartment, we go into her apartment, and it is spectacularly booby-trapped. And she goes through all, you know, when she does go home, she takes, you know, it takes her hours to get home because she'll go these random ways to try to, she thinks someone's following her. And maybe they are, as we come to find out. So it's definitely a thrill ride. If you are an anxious person, choose another book. This one is not for you. But if you want a thrill ride that's going to maybe keep you up at night a little bit, you definitely want The Final Girl Support Group by Grady Hendrix.
All right. Well, we'll top that, Cassie Rose. And you're not an anxious person either.
You're
For calm people out there who want to get goosed up a little bit, that sounds like a very good choice.
Yes.
From Chris Hickey. Cassie Rose, what do you have for us? You bring the most attractive books. I always see them upside down because of where I sit and where you sit. But The Art of Losing. Talk to me.
Is by Alice Zeniter. It's a French name, Zeniter.
Yeah.
This is a compelling read, fascinating. I just finished it. And it came out in March, but I just didn't get a chance to pick it up, and I kept wanting to. And anyway, it's about it opens with a young woman who is... She has a horrific hangover, and she just says, I can't do this anymore. Well, it turns out you don't know whether she's saying that because it's just, I can't do the drinking anymore, or because she is struggling with a family secret. And the family secret has to do with her heritage, and that is that she is French-Algerian. She works in a Paris art gallery. She's a Parisian woman, but her grandparents escaped after the War of Independence, which happened,
1960?
62. Was the signing of the Evian Accord.
Okay.
And so the question is, she does not know why her grandfather and grandmother left. What is it, this secret? Because he never talked about it anymore, nor did his oldest son, Hamid, who is her father. So the book goes back through the history of the family, and it's richly written about the mountains of northern Algeria, where the grandfather had olive groves and was prosperous and a leader of the village, and what happens when the FLN, the liberation group, comes in and basically says, you have to swear allegiance to us or we will murder you. And I will say that they do, the family escapes, but then why did they escape? Why did they not stay? You were damned either way, because if you swore allegiance to the French, then the FLN came after you. If you swore allegiance to the liberation group, then the French came after you. So it's a story about colonial life, what happened, and how those who left and settled in France, in Paris, notably this family, again, it's fiction, the internment camps that they went through, and then how they become obscure, at least her grandparents did, these leaders of their village and of this rich mountain life, and they become obscure, living in council housing and working in a factory. So then we get to the viewpoint of the son, Hamid, who merges into French society. He marries a French girl, and then now we have his daughter, the granddaughter Naima, and she needs to find out what is it that went on in Algeria that her father and grandfather do not talk about. It is very, very compelling and just richly written, and there's this odd narrative voice that pops up every once in a while, and you think, who is this? It has a very omniscient, authoritative.
So it's not one of the protagonists you just described. It's some other.
It has to
voice,
be
character.
Yes, it has to be, because it will say, something like, well, Naima didn't really think this, or if she had done this, then this would have happened. So you think, well, it's not Naima. So, and it's not Ali, the grandfather, because he's dead. So there's that question that pulls at you, too. It's a wonderful book.
The Art of Losing by Alice Zeniter. Did you know anything about the author before you read this book? Had you heard anything about her?
I had not, although she has written quite a bit in France, and I don't know if many of her books have been translated, but this one was because it got a lot of attention and started winning awards in France. And that's how it got my attention.
I was going to ask, I'm always fascinated to ask you how these books get to you so that you can give them to us, mm-hmm. which is wonderful.
This one won the Prix Goncourt Lycéen Award, not the main Prix Goncourt, which is the equivalent of our Pulitzer.
That's the greatest thing,
yes, in France. This award is chosen by high school students, which that's what fascinated me. They're the ones that choose this Prix Goncourt winner, and that fascinated me.
That's a reason to read it, as far mm-hmm. as I'm concerned, that kind mm-hmm. of recommendation. Again, the book is called The Art of Losing. It is a novel mm-hmm. by Alice Zeniter. It is has to do with surviving the Algerian Wars that mm-hmm. ended in the early 1960. And is it part of it set today?
Yes, it is. From Naima. From the
granddaughter.
Today.
Yes.
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 And so it takes you through the 1950s, the 1960s. The war happened, well, first of all, the colonization happened in 1830. That's when the invasion happened from France. And then the war happened in 1954, went on till 1962, when it was General de Gaulle, President de Gaulle.
Who ended it,
negotiated the peace.
I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. We are talking about books for the hour today with Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic, and with Chris Hickey from the Columbus Library. Chris brings us, among other things, quick picks from the library system. And we are welcoming Mark Sebastian Jordan. We're going to take a break in a moment, but we're going to come back and talk at length about Mark's new book, but I just want Mark to sort of introduce himself to everybody. You live in the Mansfield area.
Mm-hmm.
I know you on Facebook. Mm-hmm. That's how I know you. I've met you once before today.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about you and your work up in Mansfield and points elsewhere.
Well, I get around. I'm all over the place. I do a lot of work as a freelance writer, a storyteller, a historian, a music critic. I write program notes and do pre-concert lectures for the Mansfield Symphony. I actually just was recently invited to start writing some feature articles and program notes for the Cleveland Orchestra, which is very exciting.
That's the Rolls Royce. Good
for
you.
Absolutely. That's a dream.
I don't know why they didn't call me, but okay.
No.
Congratulations. That's wonderful. That's
yes.
great.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So I wear lots of different hats. The biggest compliment I ever received was one time I described a bunch of my activities to my mother, and she paused for a moment and she said, "You sure do lead an interesting life."
I think that's wonderful. If my mother were alive today, she'd say, "Very nice, get a real job." On that note, we're going to take a break and come back in 1 minute with more of All Sides Weekend Books and talk about the Celie Rose murders at Malabar Farm. Don't go away.
I'm Hanif Abdurraqib, the host of WOSU Public Media's new podcast, Small Joys. Join me each week as I talk with artists and writers about the little things that inspire us in our daily lives. From homemade mac and cheese, to video games, to 80s sitcoms, you'll hear guests celebrate what keeps them energized. Hear new episodes every Tuesday. It's Small Joys. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back with All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. Delighted to have Chris Hickey here from the Columbus Metropolitan Library. WOSU book critic Cassie Rose. They've already given us a couple of recommendations, and they'll be giving us more throughout the program. Mark Sebastian Jordan is here from the Mansfield area. He is a historian, a writer, a playwright, a program annotator, a storyteller. As his mother says, he lives a very busy life. Mark's new book is The Celie Rose Murders at Malabar Farm. It is a nonfiction book about something that happened in 1896. I could not put this book down. I read it in one sitting. You will too. Malabar Farm, Mark, is an estate in the Mansfield area that was owned by Lewis Bromfield, the writer who was he was part of the Hemingway, Gertrude Stein circle in Paris in the
20s. Absolutely. He was Gertrude Stein's best friend.
That's right. And also Edith Wharton's. Edith Wharton visited him there. He was also a farmer and a pioneer in ecology there. I'm telling a lot of people things they already know, but they might not know about the Celie Rose murders. Discuss.
Well, this is an event which happened in 1896 in a little farmhouse that is now on the property of Malabar Farm State Park, because, of course, Louis Bromfield and Malabar came along much later. This was something that happened a period of time before that, where a disturbed young woman by the name of Celie Rose murdered her entire family. She poisoned them by stirring Rough-on-Rats brand rat poison into the cottage cheese that she served them for breakfast.
Do not try this at home, okay?
Yeah, this is not a recipe show.
Okay, no,
this
right. All right.
But she did this because she had a fixation on the boy who lived next door, whose name was Guy Barry, and she was absolutely determined that someday she was going to marry Guy Barry. Now, the truth is, he actually didn't have any interest in her. He was 16 years old at the time. She was 23. But later at her trial, one of her teachers said, yeah, Celie never got much above the mental level of a first grader. Mm. So what we have is someone who was, by modern definition, apparently developmentally disabled. But as anyone who has worked with the DD community knows, you have just as much a range of personalities in that group as you do in any group of humans, from the nicest to the people who are really jerks. And Celie Rose was a very troubled individual. She had been made fun of over the years as a nickname. She was actually called Silly Rose by the children of Pleasant Valley, where she lived there. And she was known for being very, very glib, very, very silly. But as she grew up, you know, full grown and with all the hormones running, she began to fixate on men. She was interested in one of the farmers in the valley and wrote a love letter to him, and he ignored her. She wrote a love letter to another farmer, and he laughed in her face. So at that point, she decided she needed to set her sights a little differently and focused on Guy Barry. Well, Guy Barry was a nice guy. He didn't want to hurt her feelings. So he tried to kind of, you know, soft pedal it and such. Well, she took that to mean that he was absolutely into her. So she started going around saying that they were going to be getting married. Well, when George Barry, Guy's father, heard about this, he stormed over to the mill that Celie's father operated and said, why don't you get your daughter under control? She's going around telling stories about my son. And let me tell you, there's no way one of my boys is ever going to marry a girl like that. And so the parents tried to lay down the rules and get Celie to behave.
Let's make the point that in 1896, for a person who, and I think the label was much less kind 100 years ago or so, there was no help for someone.
Right.
I mean, you were very much at the mercy of the community, and I think the more bizarre your behavior might have been by their standards, the worse it would have been for everybody. And it sounds like she was pretty not controllable.
She was wayward.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is she was not so difficult that anyone considered sending her off to the state hospital.
She was also literate.
Like she was literate.
Yeah, she was,
she could read.
Yeah.
She loved reading. It was questionable to what degree she really understood and could apply what she read. But she loved reading, and she would have a sort of facile recollection of the things she read. She could spit back information about what she read. Whether she really understood it or not, questionable.
What's the leap between having a fixation on the boy next door who was kind to her and killing her family?
They tried to tell her to forget about him, to stop talking about him, stop being obsessed, don't even bring up his name anymore. And she seemed to comply with that at first. She behaved, she helped out around the house, she could do some limited cooking chores, things like that. So it seemed like that was all past. Well, it wasn't, because in her thoughts, she is still absolutely convinced that Guy Barry is going to come marry her someday. For that to happen, she has to get some obstacles out of the way. She had heard her parents discussing a case that was in the newspaper earlier about a triple murder which happened up around the Akron area. And this case had supposedly involved a farmhand who had killed the parents of a girl and in hopes that he would be able to run off with her. Well, that gave her the idea of getting rid of obstacles for love. She combined that with the fact that her family had always told her to never mess with the rat poison. They said a pinch of that stuff could kill a person, so don't you ever touch it. She may have been developmentally disabled, but she was there enough to put those pieces of information together and come up with a plan. And the plan was to get rid of her family.
The family was parents, and I got the impression that the father was rather elderly, but maybe I'm wrong.
He was. At the time this incident happened, David Rose was 67.
He was a Civil War veteran.
Civil War veteran. He had been a miller during the war. He had suffered hearing damage and eyesight damage and even stomach issues because of the war. So he was on partial disability. Her mother, Rebecca, was only a couple years younger than him. So the parents are quite elderly. She also had a brother named Walter who was...
She was the baby, right? She was the youngest. There was an older daughter who passed away, but mm-hmm. she had married and had a child and left the area. So she's home with the brother and her parents.
Yeah. Why the brother was still living with the family, we don't really know. He was 39.
He wasn't a kid either. Yeah, he was, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Celie was only 23, so there's a big gap there. And one of the many questions that arises in this story is, with such a huge gap, was Celie really David and Rebecca Rose's daughter? Or is it possible she was actually the daughter of her older sister from when she was a teenager? Mm-hmm. We'll never know. We'll never know that. But there's enough there to suggest quite a level of dysfunction in the family. A lot of tension. David Rose was said to have... a mean, explosive temper, but nonetheless, Rebecca was kind of the ultimate one in charge of the place. You know, you did not cross mother. She was the force. And Walter was known to be of very ferocious temper as well. So this was a family with a lot of tension. Living in a tiny little farmhouse, if you go to Malabar Farm and actually see the house where this took place, you can only think that place must have become a pressure cooker.
When you were describing the family and the setting in which they lived, being an old New Englander, I thought of Lizzie Borden because that was the same kind of family dynamic and they lived in this, he had a lot of money, but he just skinflint, and they lived in this little house where they were all on top of each other all the time, you know.
Right.
So what was devastating was that the father and the son died quickly.
Father died within a day or two, but Walter held on for a week.
But mom recovered, wink, wink, for a while.
Yes,
and then what happened?
Mother recovered, and meanwhile, the sheriff's department could not get a confession out of her. In fact, it appeared that the mother actually coached her on what to say because she realized, wow, they're going to take my daughter away if she confesses to this. You know, it was obvious enough to her that she did it. And she didn't want to lose the last family she had. So she made the decision to try and help Celie cover it up, coached her on what to say. And that ended up resulting in her death because Celie poisoned her a second time. Because, of course, she's still thinking, have to get to Guy Barry. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she poisoned her mother a second and final time. But during that period when the sheriff couldn't get her to confess, this is before forensics, so they have no way to prove this unless they have a witness or a confession. And they didn't have either. So they backed off and let Celie take care of her mother for those few weeks, which she actually did with great enthusiasm. She loved being important.
Until she killed her again.
Right, right. Well,
did she use the cottage cheese again, or did she come up with something else?
Well, what she did for the second poisoning is she took the first poisoning, she had mixed a spoonful of Rough on Rats in the cottage cheese. Now, Rough on Rats has a huge amount of arsenic in it, so this was arsenic poisoning, one of the worst ways to die. Well, she had a little left over. The sheriff and the prosecutor, when they were investigating, they couldn't find it because she had hid it out in the yard in a metal tin. So, okay, a bit slow, but also a bit clever in the things that,
and
that she
that
did.
Was the dichotomy, because she was clever in many different ways. And at her trial, there was that was the prosecution's hook in to trying to get our prosecution. We're struck for time here. Now, I just want to make sure people understand, A, there was no question of her guilt.
Right.
She did it. She poisoned and killed three people in her family. You write really compellingly about the trial and how, you know, she seemed well defended and thoroughly prosecuted to the extent that they could. But she herself was just not fazed by this, apparently.
She would try to pay attention at the trial, and then something would distract her and she'd go watch it instead.
Now, you write also, I don't know if we should give it away what happened. Well, I mean, it's his history. That's up to you. I mean, what?
Oh, no, that's fine. I told this story all over Ohio.
She was acquitted by reason of insanity.
Yes.
Which did not mean she got to go home.
Right.
What did it mean?
It meant that she was sent off to the state hospital system. She spent a number of years in the Lima State Hospital and then in the Toledo State Hospital, rather. And then she was transferred to the Lima State Hospital when it was built in 1915.
Which looked like an incredible. Does it still exist?
It still exists because it's too expensive to tear down.
Right. Yeah.
I tried to get permission to take some pictures of it for the book, and the state said, no, if you go there, it might fall on you.
I mean,
so they're waiting
like
for
the Pentagon.
To fall down.
It was an enormous building.
Yes,
yeah,
huge,
an enormous
huge.
Complex there. And it looked like they tried to make it a nice place for something so grim. But she spent the rest of her life there, did she not?
She did.
And died in the 1930s at 70 years old?
1934. She was one day past her 61st birthday.
And that's where she spent her life. Mm-hmm. You write that she was a model resident, I guess you call her, and was loved by her. So maybe she got
was
what
favorite.
She was looking for. Who knows?
In a way, she did. She ended up in a situation where she was fussed over and had lots of people who loved her. She kind of became a pet of the staff there.
You have written a play about this that has had several productions. I believe, was it called Seeley?
Yep.
Okay. The book is called The Seeley Rose Murders at Malabar Farm, a nonfiction book. There is one extant picture that we can authenticate of Seeley. It's on the cover of the book when she was a young girl, younger than when this happened.
No, that picture was taken in jail.
Oh, really?
That was taken in the Richland County Jail in Mansfield in 1896.
And what's also intriguing is there might be a second picture of her as an adult. And she became rather an attractive woman. I mean, if that's in fact her.
Yeah.
But you never know what's lurking beneath our beautiful historical settings.
Right.
So, again, I read this book in one sitting because I couldn't stop reading it. If this isn't an opera, I don't know what is. I mean, somebody is going to do this. You know, The Seeley Rose Murders at Malabar Farm by Mark Sebastian Jordan, highly recommended. And Mark is our guest today on today's All Sides Weekend Books. And I want to ask, as we sort of, I want to say digest, and that's a wrong choice of words, isn't it? As we process what we're hearing about this, I want to ask Chris Hickey for another quick pick from the Columbus Library.
Well, I'm not going to eat cottage cheese anytime soon.
That's not one of your snacks at the event, is it? Not that we don't all love cottage cheese.
I don't want letters, okay? Go ahead.
All right. So this is one of my favorite books that I've read this year. This was also a page-turner and read it very quickly. It's called The Forest of Vanishing Stars by Kristen Harmel. And she wrote the Book of Lost Names, which was also a very popular book. So this book, you know how we all loved Where the Crawdads Sing.
Yes.
So if Where the Crawdads Sing had a baby with any great World War II Holocaust novel, this would be the baby. So it's about a young woman named Yona who is raised in the wilderness. She's raised in the forest by a much older Jewish woman, and she teaches her how to survive. They dig, you know, they build homes into the ground every winter in a different place to survive. She knows what plants to eat. They make medicine from the plants. So if you liked that detail of nature from Where the Crawdads Sing, you will also have that in this book.
Seeley would like that.
Yes. And this woman, Yona, is also very well educated because as they steal into villages to, you know, steal supplies, she teaches her many languages, and she's very well read. So she's an educated woman who's living in the forest. And so shortly before this woman dies, this much older woman, she tells the truth. Yona is not her real name. In fact, she stole her from a family in Berlin. She felt called to steal this young child from this family of rising Nazis. Mm. And so it's the 1930s. It's they are in the Nalibaki Forest in Belarus. And she's hearing these stories that she can't believe could possibly be true in these villages of what's happening. And she starts to see Jews come into the forest to hide. And so she decides to help them hide, because one of the things that she's very good at is wiping away any traces of where she's been, because this woman has had her move around and they're able to wipe away any trace so that they can't be tracked through the forest. And so the story is about her helping these groups of Jews survive the war. And she was inspired to write this book on the Belsky Society, which were three brothers. And the movie Defiance with Daniel Craig and Liev Schreiber that came out in 2008, that's the story of the brothers. And so she actually interviewed Aaron Belsky, who was the youngest brother, when writing this book. So she had conversations with him about how they were able to survive in the forest during that time. And as you know, her father is a Nazi. So will her past come back to haunt her? Oh, yes. Forest of Vanishing Stars by Kristen Harmel. It is a beautiful book. It's fascinating, and I absolutely loved it.
It is a quick pick from the Columbus Library System brought to us by Chris Hickey, who works at the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Libraries. Remind us again of the system-wide open house.
That is going to be on August 21st. We're going to have all kinds of events at different locations.
Every
location will have things. The branch nearest for you.
Come
there will be things happening.
And bring your friends.
There will be snacks.
We're going to take a break and come back and talk to Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic. Don't go away. We are back with All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy, here with Chris Hickey from the Columbus Metropolitan Library, with Mark Sebastian Jordan, whose new book is called The Seeley Rose Murders at Malabar Farm, and WOSU book critic Cassie Rose. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com. Cassie, what do you have for us to recommend?
The next book I want to recommend is called The Great Mistake by Jonathan Lee, a book that came out this summer. It's historical fiction based on, they call him the father of Greater New York, Andrew Haswell Green. He is the gentleman who came up with and built Central Park and all the museums that are around there, and the library and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Well, the book opens with his murder on November 13th, that Friday the 13th, 1903. And they know who murders him. It's right in front of his house. A guy pulls out a gun and shoots him. And then what the author does is take that question of why did the man murder him? He accuses him of taking a woman away from him. But this Mr. Green never did marry, and we really think that there's a very subtle thought that he may have been gay. And he had a mentor and a lover who was a prominent lawyer and became a senator and also ran in the presidential race. And I always forget his name. He won the popular vote, but he did not. Samuel J. Tilden.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. I know that name. Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, the story goes, on the one hand, the investigation is very interesting just because of the chief inspector and how he is going through New York and trying to figure out why did this guy show up and kill this prominent man who was he was about 83, I think. But there's also, the author creates these two trains going on. So there's that story. And then he goes back to the beginning of the young Andrew, who was brought up on a farm, why his father sent him to New York. He went to Trinidad and worked on a plantation and then came back to New York. And under the mentorship of this very great lawyer and eventually senator, he became a lawyer himself. And then he had these grand ideas about New York, and he brought them to life. The novel is really interesting to read because of the narrative voice. It sort of sucks you in because of the way that he just commands you. It's like he's coming up, he's like a raconteur, and he comes up on stage and he says, I'm going to tell you this story about the great man of New York who built Central Park and how he was murdered and everybody was shocked and what happened in that and the why. And he takes you through with this magnificent voice, and you really can't put it down because it's not that you're intrigued by what happened. You sort of figure it out. You're intrigued by the whole the time period and who this person was and the people that he knew and how he became a self-made man and all the people that were involved with him.
The Great Mistake by Jonathan Lee. I've written that one down because that's the kind of thing that historical mm-hmm. fiction is really a thing with me. So I've written that one down. I really mm-hmm. want to look for that at the Columbus Library, which I will do as soon as we get off, mm-hmm. off the air.
It's a great book. It's a great book for the summer and for a vacation or just sitting on your porch.
You also have a book I want to ask you about because I read it years ago and loved it, The Master.
Yes, this is one of the books on my self-determined summer reading list. And I just finished this by Colm Tobin. It looks like it's Tobin, but it's Tobin is how he...
Gaelic,
yes,
Irish.
Yeah. Yes, about Henry James, the American author Henry James. And what Tobin does is he doesn't write about the great author. That's not who you think of. You see the man, Henry James, who was a solitary man. He loved his writing life. He loved his mornings of quiet. And he would go out at night and socialize. Didn't really like doing that. Didn't like all the vapid conversations. And so you get to love this person that is Henry James, and you see the quiet man. And he was not the great novelist that he is now. His brother, who was a philosopher,
William
essayist,
James,
yes, very well known, sort of poo-pooed what he was doing. And all of his friends would read his books, and they'd think, well, yeah, that one was okay. And is this really, you know, what you're going to do the rest of your life? He had one. So the book also goes into his time during the Civil War when he was at Harvard. His brothers were fighting. It goes through his relationship with his sister, Alice James, and also a relationship that he had with a woman novelist. Her name was Constance. They were very, very close, very alike in being solitudes and prolific writers. But she wanted more than he was able to give. He just did not want to get married. It's a soul-bearing book. And it is page-turning because, again, you get involved in the world. And maybe not page-turning is the right word. It's more, I want to read this book. I want the busyness of the day to end so I can be with this book.
Colm Tobin has that gift. He can make you want to read his book. He wrote a book after that in the last 5 years, a novel about Mary, the mother of
the
Jesus.
The Testament of Mary.
Yeah, it's The Testament of Mary, which is an incredible book. Yeah, mm-hmm. You don't have to be of a religious bent. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter what if you have any creed or not. It's just a very moving, yes. beautiful book.
Mm-hmm.
And
I loved that book.
Yeah, I did too. Well worth mm-hmm. reading. So I'm delighted when I saw Colm Tobin and I remember The Testament of Mary, and I know that I had read The Master years ago. And again, it was hard to put down. So I'm glad. William James, Henry James, Williams too, can be a slog to those of us in the 21st century.
Yes.
Worth it, yes. Mm-hmm. The Bostonians, I would say that, mm-hmm. is a wonderful novel, I think. But he's a lot more work than Colm Tobin is, and Tobin's no...
Right.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, if you want to take on Henry James, I think Portrait of a Lady.
Portrait of a Lady. Yeah.
The Daisy Miller.
Yeah, yeah.
Or The Turn of the Screw, The Ghost
yes.
Story.
Yes.
Yeah, those are all great books. Or you can just, you know, search Masterpiece Theater. He did a lot
you
of
You certainly
his.
Can. Or Merchant Ivory mm-hmm. Productions, if mm-hmm. you want to just go on YouTube and have a wonderful experience. But thank you for that. Henry James, Colm Tobin, and The Great Mistake by Jonathan Lee about a murder. That seems to be our theme today, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yeah.
Our murder in Old New York in 1903. Mm-hmm. Where we know who did it, but the point of doing it is the point of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Chris Hickey, I want another quick pick from you. Those titles fly off. Once in a while, you can get very surprised because you could walk in on a Saturday afternoon when the place is jumping and there'll be something there that you've wanted to read. And that happened to me with a novel called The Plot by Jean Hampf-Koretz, which is a page-turner, a great I don't mean to be patronized when I call it a great summer book, but you know what it is? It's an elliptical book because we've all gone back to the gym. Mm. And that's now I'm reading now because I go every day and I'm on the stupid elliptical reading, you know, so I don't realize how miserable I am and look because I'm reading. So I'm getting a lot of reading done. And I read that on the elliptical and it you have to have a page turner to do it. Henry James would not work.
On no, would not.
No, not Seeley all. Certainly would. My God, you know, you'd lose weight in that book. Anyway, another quick pick for us.
All right, so this one is also a page turner, and this is definitely when we say summer read, beach read. This is definitely one of those books. It's called "The View Was Exhausting." It's by two writers, Michaela Clements and Anjuli Dada. They are a married couple who wrote this book, and so it's a book about if you like relationship drama. This is a relationship drama book about a fake relationship. So. It's about an actress named Whitman Tagore, and she's a famous actress, and she has, you know, relationship problems. And unfortunately for a woman in Hollywood, relationship problems can make you look bad. That could also hurt your ability to get roles. So she works out a deal with a friend that she meets. His name is Leo, and he's a playboy, and his father is a real estate hotel tycoon. And they've worked out a deal. They've worked out a deal where they, you know, in times of trouble, when she needs a PR boost, they have a relationship. And it is one that's on Twitter and people are riveted mm-hmm. and he makes her likable. So he's very good for her career, but it's all fake. So it sounds like it's a fluffy story, but these are really well-built characters. And it is... I mean, it talks about what it means to be a woman of color in the entertainment industry. So she is British, South Asian. And so, you know, trying to get roles is very challenging for her. And so the story is really the story of their relationship as they come together in different parts of her career and what happens when they consider having a real relationship. So it is a beach read, but it also has some heart and some depth to it.
Mm-hmm. Again, so the title?
The View Was Exhausting by Michaela Clements and Anjuli Dada.
I'm interested that two authors wrote that book.
Yes.
What's that about?
There are a number of writing duos that have
even
popular
Jenna
books.
Even Jenna Ivanovich now has mm-hmm. a partner, has a writing partner, you know, and yet she brings out five or six books a year, maybe she's just needs a worker alongside her, but good for her.
Yeah, Lauren Christina, who's often a quick pick, and that Lauren Christina are two different people, and they're a writing duo. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about this one.
Oh, yes. So this is called Please, Please Tell Me. Now, this is not a quick pick, but I'm reading it, and I just have to talk about it.
Good.
It's called Please, Please Tell Me Now, The Duran Duran Story. Now, there are books out there about Duran Duran. I'm a huge fan. I love them. But this one, what makes it special is it's written by the esteemed music biographer Stephen Davis. So Stephen Davis wrote The Hammer of the Gods, the Led Zeppelin saga. He recently wrote a book about Stevie Nicks called Gold Dust Woman. So this is him digging into the Duran Duran story. And I'm still at the beginning of it, and I absolutely love it. So we're starting with John Taylor and Nick Rhodes as teens in Birmingham because they are the beginning of this story. And I feel like I'm right there with John Taylor as he's skipping school and he's going to these record shops in Birmingham and these cafes. And we see Nick Rhodes as... you know, a 14-year-old boy when he was still Nick Bates. And as he's experimenting with makeup and hair dye and these clothes, and he's creating this persona that is still with him today. So for fans of Duran Duran, you're going to get a really great deep dive into who they are as people And it is just, I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
That sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds like a great book.
Please, it is a great fun.
Please, please tell me now the Duran Duran story by Stephen Davis.
By Stephen Davis.
Great recommendation from Chris Hickey at the Columbus Library. Mark Sebastian Jordan is the author of The Celie Rose Murders at Malabar Farm. He is a storyteller, a playwright, a raconteur, a program annotator, a pre-concert speaker. What are you reading?
I am always reading a bunch of things all at once. I'm not a one-at-a-time reader. Yeah. I suffer from LBS, literary bed syndrome, where I have them stacked up one side of the bed and try not to stack in so many that there's no longer room for me. So among the things I have going now, one, I'm reading a modern translation of an ancient Celtic epic called The Gododdin. This was something that was originally written around the year 600. So we're talking roughly during the King Arthur sort of period of time. And it's something that a bard wrote about a battle where his side was completely wiped out. And he was one of the few survivors of this thing. But it's not a narrative of a battle. It's a lament for everyone who died. Well, this interests me because I'm fascinated by the whole issue of ancient bards in that culture, the Celtic culture of the British Isles. These were the people who were the acknowledged keepers of the flame of the culture. You know, they told stories. They carried the news around. They sang. They wrote poems. They worked as healers. They were often the judges for these people.
Weren't they also hired by other people, like if you wanted to court a lady or something like that?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. No. And if you wanted your little kingdom to look more impressive than the one next door, you'd steal away their bard to come over here and work for you. So the bards were as powerful as the leaders, the kings of these small kingdoms. In fact, the kings lived in fear of being made fun of by the bards because that could completely devastate their career. Well, I like the idea of trying to connect these ancient figures to artists working today because I think all of those things they did are still going on with modern creative artists, even being healers and being judges. You know, look at politicians. They try to co-opt songs for their political rallies and things like that because they understand how powerful that stuff is. So we still have bards all around us, and I'm fascinated in trying to connect all of that stuff. So reading this and getting some of the flavor of that is something I've been working on to try and make that connection.
Tell us again the title. Is the title?
The Gododdin. It's spelled G-O-D, let's see, G-O-D-O-D-D-I-N, but pronounced Gododdin.
Okay, and you're reading a modern updated translation?
A modern translation, yeah. For many years, the only translations of this, I mean, it's interesting because this was composed around the year 600. It was carried along orally for hundreds of years. It wasn't written down until something like 400 years later. And then there have been academic translations of this over the years. But the one I'm reading now is a new translation that just came out, actually written by a Welsh poet trying to restore the music of the language.
Wonderful recommendation. We have time for Cassie Rose to give us one more.
I'm going to recommend Olivia Manning. She wrote her trilogy, a World War II trilogy, the Balkan trilogy, which I have not read, but I will direct you to the blog, The Longest Chapter, where I write about Olivia Manning and two other female authors from the 20th century. People may recognize Olivia Manning because the BBC did the productions of her trilogy, but it's based on her real life experience about ordinary life during World War II, and it's based on a couple called the Pringles. I have not read it yet. I'm very excited about it. I read about it in the Times Literary Supplement. So this is a trilogy that I'm looking forward to reading. And you can read more about it on The Longest Chapter.
Speaking of The Longest Chapter, because I always like to have you give a preview. You began to do that, but what else is on The Longest Chapter that people should be looking at? TheLongestChapter.com, one big...
Correct.
There is Cassie Rose's blog.
Correct. Well, also in that same blog post, you will see a book called La Femme de Gilles by Madeleine Bourdoux, and that is about a love triangle, and that is a page-turner, and you can read it in one sitting. And before that, I had mentioned my self-directed summer reading list. Those books are all listed there, and pretty much you can see my reading life on the blog. Books that I am reading, books that I see that are coming out in the near future, and also books that I look for that have been lost into obscurity but are finding their way to being reprinted, or unacknowledged authors like these three female authors from the 20th century that you'll see today on the blog.
TheLongestChapter.com is Cassie Rose's blog. It is heartily recommended to anyone who loves to read. If you want a recommendation, go there. Cassie Rose, thank you. WOSU's book critic. Thank you, Chris Hickey from the Whetstone branch at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. The library open, running, all the books, all of the materials, and there are many, not just books, but many, many more, all available to the community. A big open house system-wide on the 21st.
August 21st.
August 21st. Mark Sebastian Jordan, your book is The Seeley Rose Murders at Malabar Farm. I suspect there's another book in the works that you'll tell us about next time you're here. You are also a playwright and a storyteller. You are up in Mansfield, but you get around as well.
I get around.
And thank you for being here today.
You're
I'm Christopher
welcome.
Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. Thank you to producer Aaron Esmond. Thank you to producer Matthew Rand, to assistant producer Bobby Gaberick. Thank you to Scott Good, who puts us on the air and keeps pointing at me and making faces at me and sending me little notes about be louder. Thank you all for listening. I'm Christopher Purdy for All Sides Weekend Books on 89.7 NPR News.